Our convention week interview blitz continues tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in that iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop right up. We've had a lot of interviews this week with various candidates seeking endorsement at this weekend's state convention of the Republican Party of Minnesota. All of those are available on our channel in your iHeartRadio app. Just search for Closing Argument. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can join us at 651-989-5855. Brad Olin takes those calls and produces the show. I have to say, just from a host perspective, I'm most interested in the interview we're about to have, because this candidate is the one who I know the least and will therefore engage in the most amount of discovery with. We have on the line with us Mary Giuliani Steffens, who is seeking the Republican endorsement for governor running this year. Welcome, Ms. Steffens.
Thank you. It's Mary Giuliani Stevens.
Stevens. I apologize for the pronunciation error. See, there you go. Proof positive. We have not met.
Exactly. Well, pleasure to meet you.
Yes, it's a pleasure to meet you as well. So the first question out of the gate that I've been given to all the candidates that we've been interviewing this week is, can you give us an update on the state of your campaign and a sense of what you're anticipating going into this weekend's important endorsement process?
Absolutely. So I'm in Duluth, here all day setting up. We came in with really a lot of momentum in the campaign. We won the straw poll, the last straw poll in CD7 by a good percentage point, and we just had continued our momentum coming in here, so we're very excited.
Yeah, I did not hear that. That's significant on the eve of the convention to win a straw poll like that. So, you know, I've been around the party for quite some time, you know, since the dawn of the Tea Party back in the 2009 era. I've attended every state convention since 2010. In fact, this one will be the first one I haven't attended since 2010. And you, from my perspective, and perhaps we're not traveling in the same circles, are coming out of the proverbial left field as a candidate for governor. Tell
no,
us.
I'm coming out of the proverbial right field, but go ahead.
Gotcha. All right. Good correction. Tell us a little bit about who you are for the sake of those who might be like myself and maybe have not met you before or come into contact with you before. You are the mayor of Woodbury, which, by the way, a couple of interesting connections that I've discovered as I was researching you. You're the mayor of Woodbury. I grew up in Cottage Grove. You went to the University of Michigan. I was born in Michigan. There's some other interesting similarities, so I'm liking what I'm seeing already so far. But give us the story on who Mary Giuliani Stevens is and why you're choosing to run.
Absolutely. So just quick background. So in 1914, my grandfather came over to Ellis Island from Italy, and he worked in the coal mines in Pennsylvania, raised six kids. My dad was one of them and came to Rochester, Minnesota to join the Mayo Clinic. So I've lived most of my life in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Rochester, like you said. So I went to the University of Michigan, got my degree, and then I came back to Minnesota, came back home, and I went to night law school, worked during the day, and went to William Mitchell College of Law. Then I worked there and eventually bought into the partnership and practiced law. And 11 years ago, ran for city council, and then in 2010, ran for the mayor of Woodbury. So I'm finishing up my second term as mayor of the ninth largest city of the state.
And talk a little bit about that experience, because, you know, you may or may not know, probably don't know, that I'm a city council member out in Albertville on the opposite side of the metro from where you're at. And I certainly know that experience has been very educational for me personally. What has it been like to be the mayor of one of the largest suburbs in the metro, is it not?
It is, yes, and fast growing. So it's had its challenges, but it's been great. And I love the executive experience, having to balance budgets, propose conservative policies.
Mm-hmm.
So to be fiscally, you know, responsible and run efficient and effective government. I've enjoyed it, and we've had great success. You know, I said we let the free market work out in Woodbury, and as a result, we've seen some tremendous, you know, business growth. We've jobs are up 17%. I think over 320 new businesses just in the last 5 years.
Sure.
Our current businesses that are there are wanting to invest and grow, so they're creating more jobs.
Yeah.
Over 3,000 new homes. So it's been great. Frustration being that to run under, you know, to run a community conservatively with conservative principles is tough in Minnesota the last 8 years.
Right.
Tougher. And I've just seen it go the wrong direction, whether it's taxes, whether it's regulations, policy. And I finally said, you know, enough is enough. So I stepped up.
Yeah, I can attest, again, you know, having grown up in the neighboring Cottage Grove a number of years ago, the growth in that area, and in Woodbury in particular, has just been astounding over the past, you know, 15 years or so. There are parts of it that are unrecognizable because they used to be farm fields, and now it's, you know, new residential developments and a lot of commercial development as well. It's just absolutely astounding.
We've had a good mix. So we still have some agriculture land,
mm-hmm.
And of course we have about 25% left to develop. And we've tackled some of our largest redevelopment projects as well. So I think one of the things that I'm proudest of is changing it into a business culture of a friendly business environment to attract those new businesses and to keep the ones we have.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, this kind of elephant in the room, so to speak, that's haunting the convention that's coming up here the day after tomorrow. Actually, I guess it starts tomorrow night. And that is the Tim Pawlenty situation. So we have the former governor who announced his candidacy and then not too long after that announced that he was not going to be attending this weekend and wasn't going to be seeking the endorsement, which virtually guarantees that there will be a primary contest in August. Is this something that you anticipated, and do you have thoughts or observations as to what this does for the convention this weekend, and how's your campaign responding?
Well, I my strategy is the same. So whether he was in or out, and when he was in, and then he was out, and then in, then out, whatever he's doing, my strategy hasn't changed in that regard. It was great to beat him down in CD1,
mm-hmm.
and he did come up and speak in CD8. There wasn't a straw poll, but we really, really liked the momentum there. And then, like I said, he didn't come to CD7. We won that decisively,
mm-hmm.
and he decided not to come to the state convention. So, again, it hasn't changed my strategy at all in terms of the endorsement process.
And in terms of that process and getting ready for a convention, you know, folks who haven't been involved with campaigns or haven't been involved in the delegate process may not be aware, but what your time is primarily being taken up with, I imagine, is being on the phone with delegates, being on the phone with alternates, talk with folks trying to secure their vote. Have there been any kind of revelations during those conversations about where Republicans in Minnesota, where the pulse is of Republicans in Minnesota right now, and what's the top couple of things on their minds?
Well, clearly Republicans are ready for a change in the governor's office,
right,
after the last 8 years. There's no doubt about it. And really, look at our tax environment. I mean, it is one of the most burdensome in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal is to get us out of the top 10 in all major tax categories. And we have to end this terrible practice of taxing Social Security benefits of our seniors. But beyond that, now with Governor Dayton vetoing the tax bill, we now have tax conformity is going to be an issue,
big
issue as we undertake, you know, get elected and undertake a new session, you know, a new year.
Yeah. Do you have thoughts on that whole process? Because one of the things that I found striking about the way the session ended and the vetoes and then him walking back and deciding he's going to go ahead and sign the bonding bill, which I'm glad he did, you know, again, as a local official, I'm sure you feel this way as well. There's definite benefits to many of the projects that were involved in that bonding bill. But it seemed as though what he did was kind of a stunt that didn't pay off for him in any way. And do you have any thoughts or observations about the process that led to him having two bills that, by vetoing them, he basically wiped out the legislative session?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think I don't think he was engaged at all during the legislative session with the leadership, and it's hard to it's hard to work things out if you don't engage until the very end, and then you come in and you say, you know, this is what I want or nothing.
Right.
And they worked hard with him. I mean, they, in that tax bill, you know, he wanted school funding.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually gave him more school funding than he asked for.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted all new funding.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't satisfied with the compromise, and he vetoed it. But he put in jeopardy most Minnesotans, because we already had, you know, high taxes. But middle-income Minnesotans, well, everyone's going to see it. A good majority of Minnesotans will see a tax increase as a result of that veto.
Mary for MNGov.com is the website. Mary, four spelled out, MNGov.com is the website. And there you can click on the issues tab, and you have a number of positions drawn out with thumbnail sketches. One of those is education. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on the state of public education here in Minnesota and what prescriptions you have for improving it.
Yeah, well, and we're resting on our laurels when it comes to education. I mean, we need to get into the 21st century with education. So what I say is, you know, I have an education policy cabinet headed up by, co-chaired by Karen Klinzing, who worked under the Pawlenty administration, and David Hahn, who is CEO of Urban Ventures, a nonprofit in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then they have a team as well. So really what we need to do is we need to get economically relevant programming back in the classroom. So we need to get those trade classes, the vo-tech classes,
right,
back in the classroom. We need to focus on our STEM classes, so our science, technology, engineering, and math.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the jobs that are out there and that are available, we're not educating our kids for those jobs.
That's right.
So there's this huge disconnect. So we got to get our education system into the 21st century. I'm a huge proponent of, choice in education. So I'd like to continue and expand that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know in Woodbury, when you look at our education system, I think one of the things that's great about it is that we have a huge homeschool group. We have a charter school, which I think is the only charter school in Minnesota that got recognized nationally last year,
mm-hmm,
Math and Science Academy. We have private schools and our public schools. I just think the more options parents have, then they can choose the right path for their, you know, their child.
We're talking with Mary Giuliani Stevens, a candidate for governor seeking the endorsement of the Republican Party of Minnesota at this weekend's state convention. When we return, we'll take your calls and questions for the gubernatorial candidate. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. We have on the line with us gubernatorial candidate seeking the Republican endorsement at this weekend's state convention of the Republican Party, Mary Giuliani Stevens. And we have a couple of folks on the line who have questions for you. Ms. Mayor?
Sure.
Let's take Cindy in Rochester. Before you get your question out, is this the Cindy I know in Rochester?
Yeah, this is the Cindy you know.
All right. Go ahead with your question.
I want to ask Mary, my husband and I are actually driving up from Rochester to Duluth as we speak, and we're wondering what your position is on the Med Council and how effective you think it is. And I'm asking because we have the DMC in Rochester, and we're kind of worried it's going to turn into a Met Council type of thing.
Let's see. We might have had a technical issue there with Mary Giuliani Stevens. Are you back on the line? Mary, are you with us? There we go.
I'm here. I heard her first part of her question, and then somehow there was an interruption with a loud noise. But she was asking about the Met Council?
Correct.
And... can you finish the rest of the question for me?
Apparently there is, and Cindy's back on the line, apparently okay. There's a analogous organization forming regional governing authority in the Rochester area that she believes might turn into something analogous to the Met Council, and she just wanted your thoughts on the Met Council itself and the idea of regional government.
Okay, well, I've been fighting the Met Council for 8 years on a host of issues. And, you know, it's the Met Council is a large, unelected body.
Mm-hmm.
The seats are appointed by the governor, and their scope has expanded exponentially, even in the 8 years that I've been mayor. So, there have been all the way back to, I remember the auditor's report in 2011 that said they needed more accountability and transparency. And we've talked for years about staggered terms, you know, and more local involvement. I think we're past that. I'd like to see a council of governments with elected officials in a much more limited scope.
Mm-hmm.
They've really expanded, and so, you know, I've been up to the legislature testifying early on the affordable housing.
Right.
You know, trying to drive their definition to include then, because when I came in as mayor, we were still, you know, in the recession, to add existing housing stock.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all, you know, it's all by definition all new for affordable housing. So I've worked with the Met Council on, you know, transit issues, housing, water, lots of water, land use. They've gotten into a lot of issues. So for me, I'd like to see it change to a council of government and have a much more limited scope.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you're looking at it from the context of municipal government, which is where you're coming from as the mayor of Woodbury.
Yeah,
you have a number of advisory boards that provide you with their opinions, whether it's the planning commission or the park board or whatever other boards you may have. And, you know, they have that ability to make recommendations, but they don't have the power to do it without you, and because you're the one who's the elected official. And similarly, if you have any sort of joint agreements with surrounding communities, you know, maybe a joint water board or whatever the case may be. I have no idea if Woodbury has something like that. But it's much more like what you're talking about, where it's representatives who have been elected who come together in a regional sort of authority that's very limited in scope and is still accountable to the people. That sounds
absolutely
like a good idea.
And the joint powers agreements are all just that. They're agreements. They're executed by, you know, the communities and the municipalities or the agencies involved, something you voluntarily get in. And, you know, the problem with a large regional planning agency, now they came in existence for the wastewater treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they did a good job on that. But when you look at, you know, kind of the one size fits all, and you're a suburban community and you aren't in agreement with, you know, where they want to see land use go.
Right.
And where they want to see transportation go, you push back.
Right.
And sometimes not real successfully.
Yeah.
So.
All right, Cindy, appreciate the call, and I hope you have a good time this weekend in Duluth. Let's go to Brian in Eagan. He also had a question for Mary Giuliani Stevens.
Yes, I did. You had some great talking points on your plan for education in Minnesota, but I noticed there was one thing that was missing, and that's accountability for the students and parent involvement. There was an article in the Star Trib some months back. They did a assessment of basic education throughout Minnesota and a couple other states, and the one thing they found is you have to show up to get an education. And I haven't seen in this state, and I've been here since 80, where they actually have truancy, where they come out and you are responsible to get to school or you pay consequences.
Yeah, I don't know what the local school districts do. I do think there are attendance requirements in school districts.
Yeah, there's attendance requirements, but when they don't show up, what do? You just let them not graduate, or I mean, it should be compulsory.
Well, I was going to say that if the consequences are you don't show up and you don't learn, then you don't graduate. I mean, I think sending them on to the next class if they haven't fulfilled it. Is not the best thing to do. I'd say there are consequences when you don't show up.
Well, that's the thing is, when I was growing up, if you didn't show up for school, the truancy officer showed up and drug your butt down there. Okay, here they don't do anything like that, but over the years I've seen them throw good money after bad, saying that's going to fix our school education system and our gaps in our educational learning, and all they do is throw money at it, and it doesn't fix anything.
Well, Brian,
like I said, you got to show up to get an education.
Yeah, well, and you hit on a good point. I mean, when we look at our achievement gap in Minnesota, I remember one of the things Governor Dayton said when he added that extra tier on the taxes was he was going to solve certain problems, and one was the achievement gap. And I don't think anybody will disagree with the fact that the achievement gap is wider now than it was back then. So, and we did spend more money. So putting more money into it is not the solution. I agree with you there.
I appreciate the call, Brian. It's an interesting perspective. I don't know that truancy is one of the primary driving forces in the achievement gap. I certainly haven't read anything to that effect. But I think that the idea, certainly an idea that's tangential to what the one you're articulating, is that there's no amount of money or government policy or laws that can be signed by a potential governor such as yourself that is going to change the culture of the home. You know, if people are not taking an interest in their own child's education, then that's not something that any government official is going to be able to fix.
They won't, and the child starts off behind right there. And then, it, you know, and when we send them to schools and we're not expecting our schools to perform,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the students are having to go to those schools and they're
right.
not getting the best teachers, then they're even getting further behind. So to me, I think you hold, you know, the school operators, you know, responsible. I think they have to be accountable. I think we want to make sure we've got good teachers in our classrooms for all our kids.
So can you give us a, because we are up against a break, kind of a preview of your final sales pitch to the delegates up in Duluth as to why you ought to be the endorsed candidate for Governor Mary Giuliani Stevens?
Well, I think I've said it all along. That's why I got in on November 29th. I think Minnesota's looking for something different. I think they're looking for somebody that hasn't been out of the old political machine and part of the political gridlock.
Right.
Somebody that's got a good track record that has come and, you know, brings a different perspective and... I think Minnesota's looking for that. I think they're looking for a new leader.
Yeah, I started off our conversation noting the fact that you and I, this is our first time interacting. I had not personally heard of you prior to your announcement for governor, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's definitely good to have a fresh perspective and to have somebody. I like the fact that you're from a municipal background, because I think there are a lot of lessons from the way municipalities are run that could be applied to state government. So it'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend, and I wish you the best.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Mary Giuliani Stevens, maryformngov.com is the website, maryformngov.com, all spelled out. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, twincitiesnewstalk.com. Well, barring a unannounced surprise call-in from a candidate who has yet to be on the program, I believe that concludes our Convention Week interview blitz here on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at twincitiesnewstalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Ullman takes those calls and produces the show. One candidate who we did not speak to on the program this week is Tim Pawlenty, who is taking, well, I was about to say he's taking a low profile. Not exactly true. He made a pretty big splash today with the announcement of his running mate, which we're going to get into here shortly. But when it comes to media appearances, it seems to be a very controlled, very reserved and scripted response in this week leading up to the convention, which makes sense. I think they want to control the narrative coming out of their campaign and having a live interview in any format, you know, the show amongst others would be one where they might have to face questions that they're not interested in answering right now.
Yeah, I think any question that would put him on his heels about not participating in the convention or...
Right. Which you would have to ask.
Driving party divide would not be a position he wants to find himself in right now.
Right. And, you know, I would ask those questions, and anybody who was remotely competent would ask those questions because those are legitimate.
I hope so.
And I think that, you know... We kind of know the answers, right? Like it's a little bit of an exercise in theater, even asking the question, because I can already imagine what the answer would be, the kind of answer that would be given, and I also have a pretty good idea on what the truth of the matter is. So, you know, it'd be entertaining, but I'm not surprised why it didn't happen. We probably will have Palenti on at some point after the convention or when we get closer to the primary. I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to arrange that. So, there is, speaking of Palenti, a couple of pieces that came out in the past couple of days relevant to that gubernatorial candidate who will not be present at the convention this weekend up in Duluth. And, you know, much ado has been made about that choice. And, you know, you see, if you have a social media news feed, anything like mine, you've seen much grouching about this move by Tim Pawlenty, the effect that it has upon the elusive party unity and the capacity of the right wing in Minnesota to get behind not just their gubernatorial candidate, but the effect it has on the other races as well. Because to the extent that the Republican Party has been hobbled by a lack of donations, which, you know, the smart money is on the theory that Pawlenty's lead up to announcing his campaign involved a lot of convincing donors not to contribute to the party and to hold back on contributing to other candidates because, hey, I might come into the race, right? That has an effect upon the other races. And, you know, I can understand why if you're Jim Neuberger or you're Karen Housley and you're running for U.S. Senate to challenge either Amy Klobuchar or Tina Smith, why that would upset you. Or if you're one of the other gubernatorial candidates seeking the endorsement, I get why that would upset you. But I imagine the calculation is we're probably not going to win the Senate races anyway. So how much harm is it really doing? You know, let's put all our chips on the governor's race. And, you know, the chief most of which is the name Tim Pawlenty, which everyone knows. It strikes me that that's likely the strategy here. But without being able to talk to the campaign directly, who knows? So, from the local CBS affiliate, Minnesota Republicans and Democrats hold conventions this weekend to pick candidates up and down the election ticket. But getting the party endorsement does not guarantee you will be the party's candidate by the time November rolls around. The political party endorsement brings significant advantages, including money, volunteers, and voter lists. But history is not always kind to party-endorsed candidates, and history may be repeating itself in 2018. Former Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty won two close elections with the GOP endorsement. He is running for a third term this year, but he is skipping the party. History shows the odds favor candidates who buck the party. Over the last 36 years, four of the last five Minnesota governors ran for office and won against the endorsed candidates in their own party. Democratic Governor Rudy Perpich started the party bucking trend in 1982 and won. Republican Governor Arne Carlson won the governor's office twice without party blessing. The next governor did not need an endorsement from Democrats or Republicans. Reform Party Governor Jesse Ventura foreshadowed Donald Trump, the anti-party politician. In 2010, DFLers banned a member of their own party from their convention. Fellow Democrat Mark Dayton committed the sin of ignoring the party and won the election on his own. Minnesota politics are unpredictable every year, this year setting up every bit like the last 40. So, you know, that last little observation there could end up becoming ironic if indeed Pawlenty is not able to pull this trick off, right? You know, if you're starting to predict that a candidate who bucks the party is going to win because he's bucking the party, then, you know, that it's no longer unpredictable, I guess. Other news coming out of the Pawlenty campaign from the Star Tribune. Former Governor Tim Pawlenty on Thursday named Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Michelle Fischbach as his running mate, tapping a longtime veteran of the legislature as he tries to mount a comeback bid. Fischbach serves as DFL Governor Mark Dayton's number two after a series of job shifts by prominent Minnesota politicians landed her in the slot. In joining Pawlenty's ticket, she's getting the opportunity to occupy it for four more years. So a very unusual situation here whereby, you know, Fischbach, it's bizarre that she is the current lieutenant governor under Democrat Mark Dayton. And of course, as you no doubt recall, that came about due to the fallout from Al Franken leaving the Senate after his multiple accusations of sexual misconduct came out. And he left, and then Tina Smith, who was the lieutenant governor, got appointed to replace him in the Senate and is up for election this year. And as a result of that vacancy, Michelle Fischbach held the position that, according to the state constitution, required her to step up and become the new lieutenant governor. And so now she's running to continue being the lieutenant governor under a different candidate. Very odd set of circumstances. You know, between that and having two U.S. Senate seats up in the same year, this is a truly, this will be the subject of nerdy activist trivia for decades to come, the election of 2018 and the various ways in which it was unique. Again, from the Star Tribune, Pawlenty said Fischbach is ready to be governor. Fischbach repeated the themes Pawlenty has been talking about since he entered the race for his old job in April. She said, "Together we will focus on putting hardworking middle-income Minnesotans first. Our efforts will include slowing down healthcare premiums, preparing Minnesotans for the workplace of the future, and making sure government is held accountable." Fischbach came to be lieutenant governor, and they give the background of the whole Al Franken thing that I just outlined. Pawlenty is not competing for the GOP endorsement at the party's state convention in Duluth this weekend. He and Fischbach will run against the endorsed GOP candidate in the August primary, and that's, of course, assuming that there is an endorsed GOP candidate. There is the outlying possibility that there will be no endorsement this weekend, and that'll lead to a... That'll certainly be unpredictable if we end up with a four-way or five-way primary race in August. And, of course, the Democrats responded to the news that Pawlenty picked his running mate. DFL Chairman Ken Martin issued a blistering statement stating, "By selecting Fischbach as his running mate, Pawlenty is abandoning any pretense of being a moderate." Fischbach represents an element of the Republican Party far out of reach with everyday Minnesotans. And then he goes on to criticize her past support of conservative social issues, which is interesting because, you know, you got the DFL on the one hand, Ken Martin on the one hand, saying that Fischbach is, you know, horrendously out of touch and far right. And then you've got activists within the Republican Party who are saying she's... I saw a meme on Facebook today of Fischbach, and the text was "Swamp Queen." Queen of the swamp. So, I mean, she can't be both of these things, right? Or maybe she can. I don't know. I don't know how that works. How you could be both a far-right threat to humanity in the state of Minnesota and also a swamp creature, part of the GOP establishment that needs to be, you know, taken out to the proverbial woodshed. But apparently, depending upon who you are, there are those various perceptions of who Michelle Fischbach is.
Well, it's not like politics haven't been subjective for a long time now anyways.
True that. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. The number to join us, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So you probably heard that Starbucks closed 8,000 of its stores on Tuesday. And they did this in order to train their employees on implicit bias, you know, to teach them how to not be racist. Apparently, that took 3 hours. 3 hours to go from, you know, card-carrying KKK members who serve coffee to well-adjusted, re-educated, productive human beings ready to go back to work and affirm the diversity rainbow.
I noticed because every white girl I knew drop dead in that 3 hour span.
That's racist.
I'm sexist. I can say that.
Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. I just find myself really shaking my head at this particular episode. Because with each new headline, with each new development in this quote story unquote, it just seems to get more and more absurd. And I question the sincerity of literally everyone involved. I question the sincerity of the two black men who were supposedly victimized and their claim of having been traumatized by being asked to leave by police, you know, when they were loitering. That's what they were doing, loitering in a Starbucks. I question their sincerity at how offended they are and how big of a deal it is to them and how harmed they were and how traumatizing it was. I question that. I question the sincerity of, you know, the broader left-wing apparatus in the culture and, of course, politically with the Democratic Party, the wringing of hands, the gnashing of teeth, the rending of robes over how horrible this is and how it's yet another example of how racist the United States is and how something simply must be done. I, of course, question that sincerity. And not to be left out of the mix, I deeply question the sincerity of Starbucks. I really, truly do. Like, the idea that they actually care one way or the other. Like, I don't think they care one way or the other about the issue. They certainly aren't conducting themselves according to any sort of articulatable principle. You know, it would be nice. It would just be nice if they took a stand on something that could be defensively called a principle and acted consistently on that. Instead, what they've tried to do is they've tried to placate. They've tried to kind of tip their hat to the concept of we did something wrong as a company, which I'm not even sure what it is that they, Starbucks, did wrong, right? Because this was the choice of a particular manager in a particular context to take an action that was consistent with not only Starbucks policy, but the law and tradition, common law tradition, ever since we've had the recognition of private property, right? Like the idea that you've seen signs on places of business for decades, right? For generations that say something to the effect of, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone.
Restrooms for paying customers only?
Restrooms for paying customers only. You know, I went to a popular Mexican establishment the other day, and I couldn't even use the restroom. I was in downtown St. Paul. They had it locked, and they had this deal where once you get your receipt, there's supposedly a code on the bottom of the receipt to get into the bathroom. Code didn't work. They didn't have their bathroom access computer synced up with their receipts or whatever the case may be. But the point is that I was not victimized, right? Nor was I traumatized. The only reason I remember it now is because we're talking about Starbucks, right? Like it was an experience that was annoying in the moment, and then I moved past it and I went on. And spoiler alert, I peed eventually, right? Like I found a place to relieve myself.
I'm happy for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Congratulations can be sent to Walter Hudson at iHeartMedia.com. But, you know, having those types of restrictions when you go into a place of business is totally normal. It's not something that is shocking and new, and it's not something that's restricted to black people. Literally anybody who walks into a Starbucks before now, before they change their policy to allow, apparently it's just a public hangout now. Apparently it's just like an alley.
Yep.
Where you can, in fact, you probably have a stronger legal claim to hang out in a Starbucks than you do to hang out in an alley. Like if you're just hanging out in an alley, the cops can come along and question why you're there, not doing anything, not engaged in any kind of business with any of the adjacent properties. What are you up to? You know, certainly if you're in New York, you're going to get a stop and frisk, whatever the case may be. But if you're in the Starbucks on the same block, you could just hang out there all day, apparently, because of the change in policy here by Starbucks. I just question the sincerity of Starbucks here in terms of, you know, actually trying to make some sort of meaningful difference in the culture and a meaningful difference in the culture of their own company by going through this kabuki theater. And that's exactly what it was. And guess what? The lefties agree. From Vice News, Starbucks racial bias training was a huge success, according to Starbucks. But one day of training isn't going to help solve the real issue, the assumptions people make based on color. This from Kristen Frazier, writing at Vice News. About 175,000 Starbucks employees watched videos and read workbooks that focused on the concept of so-called implicit bias when about 8,000 of the chain stores closed Tuesday afternoon for training. I want to get a hold of a copy. Because when they talk about implicit bias workbooks, the mental image that pops up in my head is like my 4-year-old bringing home a coloring book from preschool with different exercises of like, okay, you know, here's your available crayon colors, and we're going to judge based upon how you fill in the gaps here, just how implicitly racist you are.
Well, I would assume it would include things like don't walk up to a black person and ask if you can touch their hair, stuff like that. Like, but you know what I mean, though, like stuff that does happen. And I guess you could understand from their experience would be bothersome.
Right.
But whether that's an implicit bias or not, I'm not sure. Where you could just be polite to that person and,
well,
you know,
right.
You wouldn't walk up to anyone else and ask if you touch their hair.
And this is the part, this is why I question the sincerity of the whole thing, is because what we, the supposed problem of implicit bias, to the extent that there's anything in there that actually is a problem, it's covered by merely being professional. It's covered by merely being decent and acting in the way you're supposed to act when you're serving as an employee or serving as a waiter or a barista or whatever the case may be. The idea that we have to single out and give special attention to this concept of racial implicit bias, that's a political narrative. That has nothing whatsoever to do with practical business policy. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. That it's not limited to Starbucks, this lack of sincerity, this kabuki theater surrounding the concept of racism. And it occurs to me that virtually everyone who approaches this topic, the topic of race, to one extent or another is putting on a performance. That, you know, there may be some kernel of legitimate opinion, legitimate concern at the heart of it, but built around it is this performance that's designed to move an agenda forward that's not actually rooted in any sort of objective or rational concern. And we have a variety of recent examples here from both sides of the aisle that we're going to go through here tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's always great having you with us. 651-989-5855 is the number to join the program. Brad Omlin takes those calls and produces the show. Let's start off by talking to Steve in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening. I'm a state employee with a certain public safety aspect department. Mm-hmm. And the governor made all the public employees of a certain agency take mandatory bias training a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was given by, you know, a woman who was going to be doing this all over the state. So
right.
Not only did we get to waste 2.5 hours of our time telling us why we're, you know, potentially unknown biases,
mm-hmm.
but somebody made money off of it as well.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Wherever there is a feigned concern over some sort of, you know, bias or ism that requires training, you can see at least one non-governmental agency that's making money off of it through government grants.
Yep.
Appreciate the comment, Steve. Yeah, he kind of precluded the question, but I was going to ask him what it was like to be a reformed racist, you know. But apparently he didn't learn his lesson based upon the language he was using there. So,
I think Starbucks' new come hang out anytime / bathroom policy is more concerning in that it may be disingenuous from a or ineffective from a anti-racist standpoint, but it's a larger example of the erosion of private property and the advancement of collectivism
right.
over what you own.
Right.
And it's almost worse in this example because it wasn't mandated by the state through taxation.
Right.
It was demanded by the very fabric of our society.
Just, correct.
And imposed. Starbucks said, oh, yeah, sure, we'll do that.
Yeah.
And so it's just another example of how collectivism has reared its ugly head in affecting private property for the wrong reasons.
That is an extraordinarily sobering and essential point, and I'm really glad that you made it. The fact that this was, like, on the one hand, as a libertarian, you celebrate the fact that this wasn't a government mandate. At the same time, when you recognize that Starbucks made this decision to basically say, hey, you can hang out at our place whether you're a customer or not, that they made that decision in response to a market demand, quite ironically, a market demand that they basically disown their own private property rights.
But I don't even think it was a market demand. Like, people were obviously upset that a black guy got kicked out of Starbucks,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it went that far.
Well, don't you feel that this whole thing is marketing on their part, though? The fact that they are announcing, hey, we're shutting down our stores right during the middle of the day when you'll notice, so that we can train our 8,000 employees. I mean, it strikes me that that's much more of a marketing ploy than it is a legitimate attempt to try to deconstruct or debug people's implicit bias.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, we shall see. So another example we can look at here from the Star Tribune, and this one hits a little bit closer to home because it involves one of our own, quote unquote, a Republican leader in Florida has said he doesn't understand the anger generated by Roseanne Barr's tweet comparing a former advisor to President Barack Obama to an ape. Now, you know, in case you missed it here, this is the Valerie Jarrett comparison by Roseanne Barr. She said that Valerie Jarrett looks like a combination of, I believe it was ISIS or something to that effect, and a cast member from Planet of the Apes, which... Can we just pause to appreciate that? Whatever your analysis of the reaction to this tweet may or may not be, you know, was it an overreaction to cancel the Roseanne show in response to this? Is there a dual or a double standard in place between when it comes to the way that Hollywood and the broader culture reacts to conservatives saying outrageous things versus liberals saying outrageous things? Yes, absolutely. 100%. No doubt about it. There is a double standard. But let's keep it real, as the kids say, right? Like, this was obviously a racist statement. It was obviously a racist comment. There's no non-racist way to read what Roseanne Barr tweeted. And so in that context, continuing with the Star Tribune, Lake County Republican committee man Ralph Smith posted an image of Valerie Jarrett and a character from Planet of the Apes on Facebook with the caption, "And the issue with Roseanne is..." So he's doubling down. Barr's tweet likening Jarrett to a cross between the Muslim Brotherhood and a Planet of the Apes actor sparked nationwide criticism and prompted ABC to cancel its reboot of the comedy show Roseanne. The Daily Commercial in Leesburg, Florida, published a story Wednesday quoting Smith as saying that he thought the comparison was funny. No one answered the phone at Smith's home and business Thursday. The chairman of the Lake County Republicans didn't respond to email and phone messages. Smith deleted his post Wednesday on a radio show he hosts. He said he doesn't care about a person's color, only their values. Well, I agree with him there, but that doesn't really explain away this particular approach to Roseanne Barr's tweet. We'll get into, as we move along here, the double standard, which is definitely in play when it comes to the way that conservatives are drummed off the public stage whenever they say something the least bit controversial and lefties. But again, I don't think it's an apples-to-apples comparison to take a look at what Roseanne tweeted regarding Valerie Jarrett and compare it to, you know, something like, for instance, what Samantha Bee said about Ivanka Trump, which we'll get into here shortly. Before we do, let's talk to Anthony in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I just want to start off by saying You know, I don't agree at all with what Roseanne tweeted. That was I was out of pocket, and you know, everything that comes to her is, you know, that's the way the cards are dealt.
Right.
But with that being said, I'm a white guy, born and raised in Minneapolis, graduated from Henry High School, have a biracial family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's mixed, his mother's black. And when, you know, I have a predominantly, well, obviously, white family, mm-hmm. South Minneapolis, and, you know, when we go over family functions and stuff like that, everybody in my son, you know, in my family, you know, my son is, you know, everybody loves him together. And, you know, they'll run his fingers through his hair and talk about how much they love his hair and things
right.
like that.
Yeah. Right.
And it in no way is racist or,
right. Correct.
You know what I mean? They just actually love his hair.
That's right.
That's all there is to it.
Right.
Period.
Right.
There's nothing more to read into it. They just love his hair. They're so used to seeing straight, you know, blonde, white girl hair and stuff like that. They see some nice, curly,
it's different,
and gorgeous hair.
Yeah,
it's different. They love it.
Right.
And this translates to so many things. You know, people are walking on eggshells now. You know, you can't make a comment without, you know, somebody, you know, twisting your words.
And, right.
And no, it's just that's the way I said it. That's the way it is.
Yeah, you can't. To put another way, you can't acknowledge physical reality without somebody, you know, extrapolating.
Right. You know, and you look at a woman and you say, "Hey, Sunshine, how are you doing today?"
Right.
And she takes, "Oh my God, he came at me." No, no, you look happy.
Right.
I just compared you to the sunshine. You're bright. You're shiny. That's all there was to it. You know.
Right.
Don't read into it anymore. Your head's in the gutter, not mine.
Right. That's exactly what it is. It's projection. It's because they're going around with race at the top of their mind all the time. They assume everybody else is, too.
And it's so unfortunate, you know, because I have to teach my son now, you know, hey, take advantage of those weaknesses.
Right.
If they have white guilt and they want to give you something that you don't necessarily deserve, take it and prove to them that you deserve it. You know, and I teach my son that. I teach my kids that. You know, just, hey, you know, if this is how they want to play,
right.
To them. You know, their weakness is your strength, and take advantage of it. And I don't feel bad for people that do play the race card and do take advantage, because if you're going to be so dumb and gullible to buy into it every rip, shame on you. You know, once, shame on me. Play. You know, it was saying the book. And
that's an interesting perspective.
Take advantage of that.
I appreciate the call, Anthony. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's an interesting perspective that I have not come across before that I'm not entirely sure I disagree with. The idea that, you know, to the extent that playing the race card, which, you know, usually from a conservative perspective, when you see somebody playing the race card, you know, we criticize them for doing so. But Anthony's got an interesting point that the only reason why it's possible to do that is because people are willing to accept it. They're willing to go along with the implied script that one is supposed to follow after somebody plays the race card. And that's exactly what the Starbucks did, is they played along with the implied script right down to changing their corporate policy in a highly irrational and self-destructive manner, as far as I'm concerned. From the New York Times, Samantha Bee apologized on Thursday for having used a vulgar epithet to describe Ivanka Trump on her TBS show, saying she had crossed a line. TBS also issued an apology but took no disciplinary action against the late-night host. Ms. Bee's insult of the president's elder daughter on Wednesday's episode of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee included a crude reference for the female anatomy. I'll let you guess as to which one that was. And caused a fervor made more intense because the remark came just a day after ABC swiftly canceled Roseanne over a racist tweet by the show's star, Roseanne Barr. And so here's your comparison. Samantha Bee calling Ivanka Trump a word that is a crude reference for the female anatomy. And Roseanne Barr saying that Valerie Jarrett looks like a combination between the Muslim Brotherhood and a cast member from Planet of the Apes. Now, are both of these comments inappropriate? Yes. Are both of these comments, you know, vile and not worthy of being part of the public discourse? Absolutely. Are they apples to apples? No. No. Not really. No. You know, calling somebody a name, which is basically what Samantha Bee did, albeit a extraordinarily crude and offensive name, is not on the same level as making a comment that it has obvious racial undertones that imply a type of subhuman status to a particular race. And that's what Roseanne Barr did. It was on a whole other level. And I understand the impulse. Believe me, I get it. And we're going to get into, you know, some more of the double standards that have taken place here. I understand the desire to come out and defend literally anyone who says just about anything on the conservative side of, you know, the culture as pushback against the double standards and the sensitivity, the social justice warrior sensitivity of the left and the political correctness that's way too dominant in our culture. I get that impulse, but we have to proceed first and foremost from decency and truth and, you know, a sense of honor. You know, we have to be better than the other side. And this is a concept that, much to my chagrin, seems to have fallen completely by the wayside. We live in an era, and perhaps you agree. Perhaps you can tell me why you agree at 651-989-5855. We live in a time where the predominant attitude amongst Republicans and conservatives is we need to get down into the muck and fight fire with fire and be as rude and as nasty and as warlike and, you know, metaphorically bloodthirsty as the left and take no prisoners and say whatever, regardless of its veracity, regardless of its truth, regardless of its decency or honorability. We need to do anything in order to win, and we need to do anything because the left will, the other side will. If we hold ourselves to a higher standard, we're putting ourselves at a disadvantage and we're going to lose. Well, look, you're right to the extent that being decent, being good, valuing the truth, having principle is harder than not. It is. It takes more effort than to just get down in the muck with the lefties and play their game their way. Absolutely. But you're not securing any kind of victory by playing the game on their level. In fact, you're guaranteeing a loss, because I don't know what you're fighting for, but I'm fighting for more than just winning elections. I'm fighting for actually maintaining a culture that is affirming of moral values. And I'm not just talking about social issues here. I'm talking about the morality of individual rights. You can't make that. You can't make an argument, a moral argument, from the position of dishonorable and disgusting rhetoric. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. We've been talking about race, racism, kind of been interweaving a couple of different stories from a couple of different angles. Of course, the Starbucks ongoing drama and their effort to engage in penance for one of their managers calling the cops on a couple of black guys who were loitering in a store. And that's the kind of story that 5-10 years ago probably wouldn't even have been a story. And if it was, it would have been a blip that would have dissipated very, very quickly. But this one is kind of a cultural gift, if you want to use that terminology, that keeps on giving. And then, of course, we're also talking about the Roseanne Barr situation. She put out a tweet that basically ended her new show right as it was starting by comparing Valerie Jarrett, or saying that Valerie Jarrett looks like a combination between the Muslim Brotherhood and a cast member of the Planet of the Apes. None too subtle there. Let's talk to Joe in New Brighton. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Walter.
Hi.
Yeah, I like the show, and I think this is my second, third time calling, so I always listen to you to and from work.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, so but I was trying to weigh in regards to this Rosie O'Donnell scandal that is going around, and I have a question.
Okay.
My question is that, as I heard that she, Rosie O'Donnell, was when she made that tweet, she thought the lady, the Valerie lady, was a white lady, was a white person. So she didn't know she had any kind of black blood in her. So when she made that tweet and made that joke, she was actually doing it with the impression that this person was a white lady. Now, my question is that is the backlash, is it because the person that is the object of this joke is a black person? Or if she was going for the fact that this person was a white person, and how it turned out that this lady was a white lady?
I get the premise. I understand the premise of your question, Joe.
Same as it is right now because this person is a black person. Because I think the double standard in all these things between the black and white thing is the fact that most of the time, if you attack black people as a white person, then you get the backlash. But when if it is a black person attacking the white people, I mean, everybody is, because I don't know how is this thing different from the lady, the Michelle Wolf thing, when she went out, the press secretary lady,
uh-huh.
She went at her to the point that this lady was about to cry. And I think it was more brutal and was more horrible and like just, I mean, terrible compared to just two lines of a tweet.
So yeah, my question is, if
she was a white lady, and since Rosie O'Donnell thought this lady was a white lady, are we going to have this same kind of backlash that we are having now?
I don't think so, but the fact of the matter, whether Roseanne Barr was aware of it or not, is that she is black to some degree. And so, you know, even if she was proceeding under the assumption that Valerie Jarrett was 100% white, it's still it's an odd comment that it may not have had a racial intent. But the fact of the matter is that there's just too much. You're asking people to suspend disbelief in a major way to think that, because why would she bring up Planet of the Apes? Why would she even make that comparison?
Probably she was maybe looking at that because she think the lady is the same equal like an animal or like an ape.
Right. Like maybe it's just a comment on her appearance. I get it. The problem is that perception in these types of circumstances is a greater impact than reality. And the reason why it's not an apples to apples comparison, I appreciate the comment, Joe. The reason why it's not an apples to apples comparison to the Michelle Wolf situation going after Sarah Huckabee Sanders, or the deal with Samantha Bee, we were just talking about, who went after Ivanka Trump lately with a very vile comment, absolutely horrendous, completely, you know, by her own admission, over the line, unacceptable, right? Even so, it's not the same, because both of those comments, the one directed against Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the one directed against Ivanka Trump, were individualized, right? It was a nasty comment to a person or about a person as an individual. It wasn't a generalization about an entire group of people based upon a arbitrary characteristic like race. And that's the difference between what Roseanne Barr tweeted and what Samantha Bee did and what Michelle Wolf did. And, you know, is the response by the broader culture and by the media indicative of a double standard in how conservatives and liberals are treated? Absolutely. There's no question about that. But I think when we pretend as though it's an apples to apples comparison as to what Roseanne Barr said versus what the other two said, that we're lending credence to the idea that we're okay with racism. And I don't think that's a healthy position to stake out in election season specifically, and in the culture more generally. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Utzon. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Talking about immigration quite a bit on the program as of late. It's a topic that I steered clear of for about the first year of the show. It's never been a topic that I've been particularly comfortable with until recently, I guess. And that was because, you know, I don't view it as a single issue. I view it as the nexus of all other public policy. And, you know, the positions that people stake out on immigration are a good indicator of what their broader worldview is. It tells you what they believe about the welfare state. It tells you what they believe about the general role and scope of government and what that role and scope ought to be. It's an indication of how consistent they are with their professed principles, particularly if they identify as conservative or libertarian. And so, you know, it's interesting for that perspective, and we've been talking about it from that perspective of, you know, what is a, how do you apply the principles of constitutionally limited government, fiscal responsibility, free markets, and all these things that are generally applauded at Tea Parties and at Republican conventions and wherever Republican candidates are giving speeches and they evoke these terms. How do you apply those to the question of immigration and how immigration ought to work? Well, there's an interesting perspective that I happen to find myself largely in agreement with that was shared by podcaster and intellectual Jacob Brunton on Facebook. We'll get to it here momentarily. Closing argument. My name's Walter Essen, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. So to set the stage here, let's take a look at a situation in Kansas from the Star Tribune. A Republican candidate for Kansas governor who has advised President Donald Trump is attacking a state law that helps young people living in the U.S. illegally go to state colleges, appealing to his party's conservative base in a tough GOP primary race. Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach tweeted recently that repealing the policy of allowing some young immigrants to pay the lower tuition rates reserved for legal state residents would stem the rising tide of tuition hikes. He backed off that questionable claim earlier this week, but argued that the law subsidizes illegal immigration and is unfair to legal U.S. residents. The law has split Republicans since its enactment in 2004, and of the eight major candidates, the only other to support its repeal is GOP Governor Jeff Collier. Democratic and independent candidates said the law helps young people brought to the U.S. illegally as children and accused Kobach of sowing political divisions. But Kobach's tweet in the wake of proposals from state universities to raise tuition followed a GOP primary for Georgia governor that became a contest of which candidate would be toughest on illegal immigration. Georgia Secretary of State Brian Kemp advanced to a July 24th runoff after boasting in an ad about owning a big truck in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. That was a quote in his ad. That is a smart issue to talk about with Republican voters, Patrick Miller, a University of Kansas political scientist, said Thursday. Kobach's probably not going to get those more centrist voters. He really needs to own that conservative vote. And that's what I want to focus on, is the notion that this is the conservative position. The conservative position is that we ought to, you know, be running around with trucks, rounding people up and taking them back home and what have you, including Dreamers. Let me concede a point that I think is totally legitimate. And that's the rule of law consideration. Personally, I balk at and would not support the idea, and I don't know what the status quo is in Minnesota. We could probably find out easily enough. But the idea of providing or offering in-state tuition to illegal immigrants is something that I think is moronic just from a rule of law standpoint. If you're going to go to all the trouble of having immigration status, and that immigration status is supposed to be meaningful, then having policies that basically legitimize living here illegally, immigrating here illegally, strikes me as a conflict that undermines the rule of law. And, you know, there are higher considerations than rule of law. I believe that individual rights is a higher consideration than rule of law. However, there is, in practical terms, there is a balance that needs to be struck. You know, the importance of maintaining rule of law is that, you know, you want, it's better to live in an effect under the, in the context of an effective government, even if that government is imperfect, even if the laws need to be changed. It's better to live in the context where the laws are enforced effectively than to live in a context where the government is not capable of enforcing its own law, because that's a condition of anarchy where individual rights in a broader sense are not protected. And so, you know, this idea that, well, it's the law, therefore it ought to be enforced, therefore there should not be the extension of in-state tuition to illegal immigrants, I find some merit in that. That said, it's interesting to me that conservatives in this context are effectively arguing for government subsidy, because that's what in-state tuition is, right? They're effectively arguing for the public higher education system, because that's the context in which this entire argument is taking place. And it's indicative to me of many of the style of argument that you often hear whenever the topic of immigration is raised from a lot of folks who identify as conservative and consider themselves to be conservative. It's this style of argument that says, we can't afford to pay for the illegal immigrants to do X, Y, or Z, whether it's go to school or go to college or get medical care or whatever the case may be. We can't afford that, not because government shouldn't be doing those things, but we can't afford it because then we won't have enough money to pay for mine. Right? It's not a principled objection to the concept of a welfare state. It's the desire to have exclusive access to the welfare state. And I'm not sure when that became a conservative position. Jacob Brunton, who is one half of a podcast team, the name of their podcast is the New Christian Intellectual. You can find it wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. His name's Jacob Brunton. He put it this way on Facebook. The reason conservatives are anti-immigration, they're half-hearted socialists. They don't think you have the right to a certain wage, but you do have a right to a certain job, the so-called, or the government should forcibly keep competition for your job out of the country. That's the application. They don't want to get rid of the welfare state. They just want to limit it to those who are born here. Get rid of the socialistic aims and immigration becomes a non-issue, as it should be. Conservatives are doubly guilty on this. One, they are guilty for arbitrarily restricting the movement and trade of innocent people. And two, they are guilty of the moral cowardice of not fighting all aspects of socialism with full, consistent conviction. Pretty harsh language there from Jacob Brunton, but I can't find myself arguing with it. I don't. There's no point here where I would say, yeah, he's wrong about that. Because what he's saying is there's an underlying principle. And these are principles that we constantly tout on the right, from the platform of the Republican Party, from the underneath the moniker of conservative. We tout the idea that the government should not be involved in economic interventions to determine, you know, what minimum wages ought to be, or what the terms of employment relationship should be, or how contracts are negotiated with public employees, right? We talk about how we don't want there to be a welfare state. We need to have fiscal responsibility. We need to cut government spending. We need to shrink the size and scope of government. And yet when it comes to the context of something like immigration, suddenly all of those principles go out the window, and the argument becomes we like those things for us. And because we want to keep those things for us, we can't extend them to people who move here from somewhere else. Odd. Odd in my view. From Politico, Senator Jeff Flake wrote online Tuesday, this is from earlier this week, that he will not support the White House's nominee to lead the State Department office that oversees refugees because of the man's hardline anti-immigration rhetoric. The Trump administration announced last week that President Donald Trump had nominated Ronald Mortensen, a fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, to be Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. Oof. That's a mouthful. The Center for Immigration Studies, labels itself as nonpartisan and independent, but the left-leaning Southern Poverty Law Center has identified it as a hate group, in part because it has routinely disseminated the works of white nationalist writers. Now, I have no idea whether or not the Center for Immigration Studies, of which this Ronald Mortensen is a part, who was nominated by Donald Trump to head up the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, I have no idea if they actually have disseminated the works of actual white nationalist writers. It's hard to take the Southern Poverty Law Center at their word, because the Southern Poverty Law Center, to say they're left-leaning, as Politico does here, is a little bit of a euphemism. The organization exists for the singular purpose of disparaging right-wing individuals and organizations and labeling them as racist, labeling them as bigoted, labeling them as haters in order to dismiss any or preclude any consideration of their arguments. And so it's hard to take them at face value. However, if it's true that this Center for Immigration Studies has been disseminating work of white nationalist writers from alt-right figures, that's a problem, isn't it? And that is something that should be rejected. And unfortunately, you know, Jeff Flake being Jeff Flake, his stand here probably isn't going to get too much recognition. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Final segment this evening. Let's talk to Barry in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hey, I think your argument is disingenuous about what you're saying. Let's be honest here. Politics is the art of what is possible, and what you're asking for isn't possible right now. Just like you say, we can't make step forward toward where we want to be. We have to take what we can get. I think that's what the argument is about conservatives, about this whole immigration thing and a whole bunch of other stuff. We're trying to do what we can to move it towards where we want it to be, not away from where we want it.
So where is it that you want it to be? Like, what's the ideal that you're compromising in order to advocate for the status quo of the conservative argument on immigration?
Ideally, we'd have the government less involved in social programs, are not at all involved in social programs,
mm-hmm.
so that we wouldn't have the driver to have people come here, and then we'd open up immigration, more legal immigration, to be able to bring the people that would help us and grow our country towards where we want it to be, and that would help them also, because we'd have a better group of people here anyway.
Well, here's the concession I'll give you. I would be entirely on board with a long-term plan that said, listen, we need to limit immigration now because it's not fiscally responsible given the current state of, you know, all these entitlements and the welfare state and what have you. But the long-term plan is we don't have something fundamentally against the idea of people immigrating here. But we have to get our house in order first. We have to get to a point where we actually have a more libertarian society, and then we can talk about, you know, freeing things up. I would be on board with that, but I don't perceive that to be the argument that anybody is making. You may be making it here tonight, and I applaud you for it, but I don't think that's what Trump is going for, or what a lot of the people who voted for Trump are going for.
Do you think Trump is conservative?
No.
Because you're trying to make the argument of conservative.
Well, who's supporting him, though? But who's supporting him, Barry?
I don't disagree, but maybe it's the best option of all the whole bunch of bad options, because isn't that what everybody said when they were looking at all the stuff? So, but you're mixing up issues. The whole thing is, it's kind of like what liberals do with guns. Do you think they really want to just limit AR-15s? No. They want to take away our Second Amendment rights. That's what they want to do. But they can't say that openly, and when it gets said, it's made up a joke. You know,
I'm not sure I follow the comparison.
So do you think liberals want to just take away AR-15s, or do you think they want to take away everything?
Well, it depends on which one you're talking to, but I think, yes, to your point, there's more. Whatever they're offering today is the tip of the iceberg of what they want to do tomorrow.
Okay, so what's the difference between what conservatives are doing, what they're asking for, and what they really want?
Because I don't hear people. I don't hear people arguing from the position of the welfare state is bad, entitlements are bad, and we need to have less people on them, therefore we should limit immigration. That's not the argument I'm hearing. The argument I'm hearing is we need to protect the culture, we need to save American jobs, we need to maintain the viability of our entitlements.
Why do you think that you're not hearing that argument?
Because I don't think people actually are concerned with that.
Because you say that people come here...
What would happen if that argument was made in public on CNN?
Well, nothing worse than what's happening now. Nothing worse than what's happening now. Conservatives are going to be called, you know, retrogrades no matter what their position they take. So why not take the position you actually have if, in fact, it's what you're articulating?
I don't disagree with that, but I don't think that's the way politicians work.
Fair enough.
On a national scale, I don't think that's the way it works. I think locally, you'll hear people talk about it. I think on a radio station like this, you'll hear people talk about it. But you think on a radio station like Rush Limbaugh or something like that, you'll have a big national figure come on and say that. I don't.
Well, maybe not, but I think the reason you won't is because they genuinely don't believe it. I don't think it's because they're keeping their cards close to their chest. I think it's because they don't believe it. They don't actually hold those principles.
I think they're afraid of the political backlash to it. I think they're afraid of the friends that they have to have to make stuff happen, that they'll tip them off. I think that's what happens. I understand we should keep our ideas pure and everything, but that's not the way it works when you have a Big Ten conservative party or Big Ten Republican party. That's how Trump became part of it.
I appreciate your comments, Barry. It's an interesting perspective. Not one that I share, but I could definitely see the consistency with the premises that you're starting from, how you get to your end conclusion. Let's talk to Sue in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I take exception to the article you were quoting about in-state tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps I misunderstood you, but I understood you to say that in-state tuition is kind of a welfare for people in the state.
To the extent that public education is something, because that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about in-state tuition, we're talking about public universities. That's the context.
Right.
And the public education system itself, including the public higher education institutions, is inherently an entitlement program. It's inherently a subsidy.
Well, the thing is that in-state tuition, the schools were set up for the people in the state, supposedly.
Right.
And
theoretically,
tuition is for people who, and their offspring, for people who have worked and paid taxes to support that.
Okay. So, but here's the thing:
whereas when they come in from out of state, they have paid no taxes to support the institution. Therefore, they should pay more tuition.
I appreciate the point, Sue. We're running it at the end of the show here, but my understanding is, and I don't know the exact cutoff, but you don't have to live here for very long before you qualify for in-state tuition. I believe it's 6 months to a year, somewhere in that zone. It's just like with voting. You know, I think voting, it's even shorter, you know, a number of weeks or months before you're able to vote as a resident of the state that you moved to from somewhere else. So if people are coming here from Wisconsin, they live here for 6 months, and all of a sudden they're getting in-state tuition, the exact same argument applies to them. Suddenly they're being subsidized by Minnesota taxpayers who've been here all their lives. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.